Hey, what's up, guys? Lucas Burnley here. You are listening to the Edge and Flow podcast. We're coming back after a little beginning of the year hiatus here with my co-host, TJ Schwartz. How's it going, TJ?
Going real well.
Hey, man.
Burrowed my way through the snow to get to the shop this morning.
I've shoveled so much in the last couple of days. I'm like, I bought a double wide shovel, which
Nice.
we
It's
get
hard on
like,
the back, good on
it's
the
hard.
snow.
It's actually easier. This is like old man stuff. It's easier on the back, but the snow has to be dry. It's called a man plow. It's really, really catchy.
There you go.
But dude, it's amazing. Like, we have a long driveway, so just like being able to hit it two sides at once, kind of like 60 inches wide or something like that. It's pretty good. Okay, that's super boring stuff. Dude, we got a lot to talk about today. Like, I mean, as you would expect after not recording for close to a month, where should we start?
That was a great question.
Do
I
we start with
guess.
Patreon just because that's an
Yeah,
easy house cleaning?
let's do that.
Okay. As we've like done this podcast, this has all kind of been an experiment. Patreon was an idea for creating like every podcast, like a little sub community, but we have to feel like we're creating value for the members in there. Over this last month, we've kind of realized that what we want to be doing is recording when we want to and have time, and not feeling like either that we're super obligated to record or that we're not providing value. So are we gonna kill Patreon?
Yeah, I think we enjoy talking to you and I. We enjoy sharing what we're talking about. I think this is a
Yep.
great podcast. I think we can enjoy this for hopefully the pretty far into the future doing this.
Exactly.
And I just don't know that it's fair to treat it transactionally if that
Yep.
sort of is how Patreon makes it feel to us.
Yeah.
And maybe people care, maybe people don't. But like, I guess for us, we kind of talked about it, and it's like feeling like we owe someone when recording and talking maybe changes the dynamic and gives us
Yeah, totally. What we
an
talk
obligation
about.
and stuff.
Yep.
And so it just out of honesty, we're just kind of like maybe we just offer it 100% for free. We're not asking for any support.
Yep.
Just tune in. We're gonna talk. We're gonna get together whenever we can, and we'd
Yep.
love to have you guys listening. But just in good conscience, don't really want to take
Yeah.
money.
Yeah,
So,
I feel pretty good about that. And like, we only had one Patreon tier at $5, but and I get it. It's like, we're doing this and people want to support and we're super grateful for that. But like, we also look, and part of our goal was to give people who are listening a place to like chat and talk. And no one's really hanging out on Patreon. It's like the most of the questions come through Instagram or Facebook anyway. And so I look at it, it's like one area where we can kind of streamline a little bit, pull a little bit of pressure from what we're recording, and then you guys can just reach out, like come check out Burnley Knives Facebook group or Schwartz Knives Facebook group, ask questions or send us DMs, emails, and yeah, we're still here.
And I always talk about the Business of Machining podcast that John Grimsmo does with John Saunders, and that's kind of where they've landed. They've done it for like 6 years, and that what we're discussing here, where it's like there's no Patreon, there's no
Yep.
Instagram, like it's just us talking.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of where we're at now, and I think I prefer that and like
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. Agreed.
So yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, all that, like, the experimental quality of this plays. And like, when I look at it, like, I love monetizing things. It's not purely because of the money, but it's because of a strategy around it and like experimenting and trying. And like, you just realize you're like, sometimes there's things that don't actually need to be monetized in really any way. So, cool. Okay. That's one. Patreon going away. Thank you guys for the support. And yeah, we appreciate you. Round two. What's next?
Yeah, so you're looking at doing something pretty big.
Oh, man. So I just did something pretty big and looking at doing something pretty big. They kind of work hand in hand. Do we start with the machine or
Start, let's do chronological.
chronological? Okay. I talk a lot about diversification, right? I've been a knife maker for 20 plus years. I talk a lot about figuring out different ways to invest, to make money, to like bolster your business. Maddie and I just bought our first investment property, which basically took a month of like really active strategy and luck and like good fortune and all of these different components to work out. But it's really, really cool. So, I think most people know that like I have my shop at my house still. I have a 1500 square foot shop, detached, separated. Okay. This is basically the setup I've had since I was 24. Okay. My first house had it. It's what I've always looked for. We happened to find a property directly across the street from us that the owner had done the exact same thing. It's basically a tidy little 1100 square foot house and a 1100 square foot shop with a 600 square foot like apartment kind of above it. And so it gives us room to expand a little bit of our shop space.
I have one question.
Lay it.
What's better than one shop?
Dude, two shops is better than one shop. It feels pretty good. And this is all in this effort of balance, right? Like your shop right now, your commercial shop is close to your family, right? Everything's close. Your kids are small. Looking in Bend, I got to this point where I realized I can't afford to buy commercial space right now. It's $1 million. Okay. I also, my kids are small and I've worked from home for so long. Like I do want to stay close. This is one of those kind of lateral moves that satisfies a few different categories of life, which is like we're going to rent long-term rent the house. Okay. It gives us some rental income or if nothing else helps pay the mortgage. The business offsets part of the mortgage by me paying rent, essentially renting shop space from a new LLC. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we have an apartment up top where like friends and family can stay or like makers come and do a collab. And that to me is like foundationally, like building community and maintaining community is so important.
Mm-hmm.
A commercial space by itself didn't do that. And so when I was looking, I was like, it's a lot of money. It doesn't solve any one problem, maybe in like the best possible way, but it solves all of these kind of, you know, not problems, but it just creates like a lot of like opportunity and
yeah, more
flexibility.
Room to run.
More room to run. Yeah.
You double the size of your shop, satellite shop anyway.
Yeah. And that was when I was looking at like, we worked up a prospectus based on like the cost of the house and like rental income and all of these different things. And I was like, okay, if I use it as a shop, what am I paying for that space? And it's like, basically like, I would be paying very similar in a lease for commercial space, but the closest I could get is probably 2 miles away. And then I'm leasing space. I'm not, and it would be
no,
the same.
No equity.
No yeah. equity. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's just like these little pieces you put together. So, there's limitations. The big goal is to start hiring again and realizing like we've talked about this on the pod, like, at the point where I need more than one machine or more than one employee, I kind of need to have a different spot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This provides that, which is I'm basically on site and I still get to keep my shop. I can put another machine in, and we're at the point where we do need another machine. And that's this all kind of like worked out at the same time.
Which brings us to what we just spent an hour talking about.
Yes, dude, which is the sickest, most fun dopamine conversation ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've been going over
spindle in.
Yeah, dude. We've been going Sile or Haas back and forth since you bought your X7.
Mm-hmm. 3 years ago now.
3 years ago now. You are now at 2 Siles. You are team Sile.
With nuance, but yes.
With nuance.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have a Sile hand tattoo yet, but like, that's why it fits.
Yeah, that
some good true. Job stoppers.
Haas fits as well for you.
If you do it, I'll do it.
There we go.
So basically, I think I'm doing a super mini with a lot of upgrades. And what we just did was we compared like spec for spec the Super Mini to the X7 to the X9 to the VF2 SS. Okay. Where do we end up? Like,
where I've kind of landed is cup wheel grinding is a major component of this.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you cannot cup wheel grind with a BT30, but if you're buying a machine and you really have an eye for the cup wheel grinding, I really think Cat 40 is a smart move.
Yeah.
So that naturally kind of slices the X7 out. We've had an X7 for 3 years and we never cup wheel ground on it. We probably could have a little bit here and there. But that's part of why we bought the X9 was the Cat 40 spindle. So that kind of narrows it down to the VF2, the X9,
and or the Super Mini.
The Super Mini. Because so, Haas basically puts Cat 40s in
everything. Yeah. The DT machines have, I think, BT30.
Although you can just get the DM, which has
The DM
the Cat 40.
Yeah. Okay. So this was kind of fun because I almost had to look at it from the perspective of me starting out with CNC like 12 years ago and where I would have gone and where you started out. Dude, the X7 is a crazy value proposition. Okay. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for Cat 40 comparable to the Super Mini, you don't get as many tools and you don't get through spindle coolant. Okay.
Yeah.
But you get a machine that at $40,000 offers everything that the Haas does outside of those last couple features for literally half the price.
Yeah.
Like the Haas is coming out around 70,000.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I guess we didn't compare it stock to stock, but that's because there was a bunch of options that we wanted. So the Sile includes all of these options that you would have to purchase with the Haas.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think that's where a lot of people get a little hung up when they look at, is they look at the base price of like the Super Mini and the X7. They're like, well, they're basically the same price. Go Haas. But until you get a quote, because obviously Sile doesn't have such a perfectly engineered like user interface on their site, it's not like, because that's one thing Haas is amazing at, is that the way you order a machine with all the check boxes and all that with Sile, it's a little more like any other company, which is like tell them what you want and they give you a PDF quote, right? But if you actually get a quote and you actually look at the X7, basically all the stuff that's interesting and important that we talked about is like standard. So like my X7, for example, basically has no options. Basically just the base machine.
And that makes sense. I mean, it was not your first machine. It was your second, but it upgraded all of the things that you needed from your first machine. And this is like an area that's always been hard for me with buying almost anything, right? Which is what do I actually need versus what are the options that are available? And my brain is like, get all the options. That's like super cool, especially when you're financing, because it's a lot of times it's easier to finance in some option than it is to come up with cash for it down the line.
Yeah.
This exercise has been really good though, because there are different ways to like look at machines or anything for your shop, right? And there's a bottom line component that is super important. What can you afford? Okay. So if that is your primary criteria, you pick the best thing in that window that you can afford. Okay. Then it starts to be around like value. So we'll go into the value proposition. When I first looked at the Super Mini and optioned it out, I decided to do the same thing with a VF2 SS. Okay. By all measurable standards, it is a more capable machine. It's a bigger machine. Old machinist adage of like, buy the most machine you can afford, buy the biggest, the heaviest, all of this. Okay. I'm not a machinist. I'm a knife maker. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm a knife maker with space and power limitations. And so I priced out the VF2 SS. It's $10,000, give or take, more than a Super Mini. And it's really easy.
It's like 90-ish.
Yeah, it came out to like, 100. But that's with through spindle coolant and everything. It was like the Super Mini priced out at 82. The VF2 SS optioned the same way. priced at probably 92.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sounds right.
But I don't actually need it. And that right now I look and I'm like, man, I lose like 2 feet of space in my shop. 2 feet is a workbench for me. And this is kind of the personal criteria that I think we go through looking at machines that's easy to miss, right? And just be like, well, dude, I'm gonna buy that because it's like, yeah, I do want to upsize my Happy Meal, you know, because mm-hmm, 50 mm-hmm. cents is cheaper. But I decided, like looking through it, I decided, okay, for now, the goal is to update my current machine, which I, at this point, like when I'm building folders, it would be really nice to have more than 6,000 RPM spindle and more than 10 tool changer.
Yeah, that's rough. Yeah.
Inside of a space. And like, so that criteria is like leaning towards a mini mill, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now we have these new manufacturing processes and new like cup wheel grinding. The X7, if the first set of criteria was the only thing, it would actually be the perfect machine for me. If I was like, I just need to make folders better, I need a little higher speeds, space is a concern.
Yeah, I'll X7. Say it right now, like the garage machine.
Yeah.
That is like the maker's first machine. Like I'm going to make titanium folders, whatever.
Yeah.
Holy cow. The X7, dude. Oh my gosh. It's
I would 100 even.
Yeah.
Even where I'm at now, I would 100%. If I was starting, I would go there. If I wasn't buying a used machine. The other thing, there's a component here. It's who, you know, so when I started machining, Pat Pruitt was the one who like got me started, helped me create my first like CAD and CAM, let me come run parts on his Haas, right? And it's like, if you're old school knife maker, man, if your mentor uses a Bader B3, guess what grinder you're probably gonna buy?
Yeah, exactly.
Like there's a really good chance. Okay. Mm-hmm. So for me, Haas, it's been there from the beginning. I also, they had them at like a trade school that I was a tech at. Like it's real familiar, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's familiar for most.
It's like familiar
the
for Haas most.
Is the most familiar. Okay. Yeah.
Sile didn't exist when I bought my Haas. Totally. I bought a used Haas. I did the same thing. Had it existed 100%, I think that is the move for new makers.
Yeah. The used Haas used to be like the play.
Yeah.
For a long time. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's not valuable. I think a used Haas is still a valuable possibility. Yeah. But like a new X7, holy cow. Like it was almost like they knew what knife makers needed when they designed that machine. You know what I mean?
Totally. It's just a small shop. It's like the small machine shop. I think looking through the line with TJ this morning, what I think with Sile is I think they actually did something really interesting, which is like to go between the margins. So if you were looking at a Haas office mill or a mini mill, the X7 is like kind of in this middle ground. If you were looking at a mini mill or a VF2SS, the X9 actually offers like more than the VF2SS in a form factor and price that's like super mini mill. It's really interesting. It's like they don't line. You can't apples to apples either one.
Yeah. It's kind of a mismatch.
But it's a mismatch, but you can get, if you're basing it on your priorities, you can figure out where that lies. Like so where we ended up basically is I would have to go to an X9 to get what I'm getting out of the super mini, but I would actually get more capacity potential than I would basically with like a VF2SS.
Yeah, because the X9 is the smallest machine that Sile makes. That's Cat 40.
That's Cat 40.
So that kind of, for me, that was why I bought it. I was like, what's the smallest Cat 40 machine I can buy from Sile?
Yeah. So this, like, where did we end up? So the other component of this is like general pricing and cost. Where we ended up with me for a super mini, since I'm gonna finance it, is Haas has like 0% interest financing. And so when we're looking at this, it's like, if you're going to finance a SILE, you're doing it through a secondary, not an in-house financing department. Right. They're not going to offer, it's like Harley, man. They're like, you want a bike? We'll get you a bike. Like, no problem. That's Haas.
Yeah.
Right. You're going through a separate, and interest rate right now is super high. So what we kind of figured out is to do a similar loan right now, if you're not buying outright, raises the price of the SILE by about 12 grand over the course of a loan.
For an X9.
For an X9. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, dude, it's really a tricky decision.
There's a lot to look at.
I can
see both ways. Like, like you started out, like I like my styles a lot, but I can totally see why you would want to go with Haas. And I wouldn't begrudge that. I think I've been on a campaign to like make sure that people understand what it is they're deciding against.
Yeah.
Because it's like the reasons to buy Haas are still there. If you really like the ability to service the machine, if you really like the ability to hire a machinist that knows how to run it, more than likely, they're very big arguments. But like I said, that's where if you're a kind of a sole authorship shop, you don't know how to run anything yet. And it's like, and you're looking for some value. Like, I think there's just a lot of people that don't even know about SILE. So it's like, that's sort of where my campaign comes from, is like, just look at this, like read this, look at the numbers,
look at the specs,
look at this stuff, look at the specs, and then make a decision. Don't like look at the base price and then just gloss over it.
Yeah. Base price is not the price. So you keyed on two of the big elements of why I'm leaning towards Haas, right? Mm-hmm. Which is I am not a machinist. Like, I figure things out. I have all of this time with like a Haas control. Can I learn a new control? Yeah, absolutely. But it's just like, it's removing pain points. So it's one, I'm kind of familiar with Haas and I already have one, which I will keep. Okay. That now means I have two machines that if I have service done on one machine, I've got a tech here. These are small things. Like, you're not getting service on machines all the time. Hopefully you're not crashing it, but I have crashed my machine and I have had service calls. And with Haas, you get that ability that like a dude shows up in a van with parts on the van. Okay. I think there's 100 Haas machines or 150 Haas machines in the Bend area. That means I can piggyback off a service. Okay. If I hire a kid out of the machine school, like up in Redmond, I think there's a tech college that does some like a CNC machining course. There's a really good chance they're familiar with Haas.
It's probably almost guaranteed. That's
almost guaranteed, right?
Yeah.
Cause they probably have education mini mills or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that matter? Can they learn a new control? Yeah. But this is where it starts to fit into like, almost like the way I was talking about the investment property. It's like, it's not any one specific reason. It's not purely bottom line, purely features, pure. It's this like amalgamation of all of the kind of features, criteria, limitations. Like, I realize that like with Haas in certain areas, I'm paying a premium for convenience. It's just like you're paying a premium to buy a mini mill over a VF2 SS. You're paying a premium for size. You're paying more to get smaller.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I think at this point, like, I mean, this has been an ongoing conversation for you and me for literally 2 years, because I've known that a machine purchase is coming.
Yeah.
And just trying to like figure out like, geez, like what lane do I go in? At this point, I'm going to order a super mini.
Do it. I think it's fit for you. I think it works.
And that's the thing. It's like, you pick the thing that works for you. Mm-hmm. Based on what you need, and hopefully give yourself some potential for the thing that's coming down the line. But you also can't plan. You can't plan too far ahead. And that, like, for instance, we looked at buying two machines at the same time. And what I realized is like that I actually don't need. What I need is the most capable single machine that upgrades my current operations.
Yeah.
And lets me start developing the next like cycle but there's a very real possibility that then I don't know what I need for the next machine.
Exactly. There's that. And then also, if you have two machines, you need two machines worth of fixtures. You need two machines worth of processes that are dialed in. And it's like, if the first machine can optimize and dial in all those things, make all the fixtures so that when the second machine hits, you just throw the Pearson pallet in there and you roll.
And you're
because
and
it's already, because you're already tapped out on spindle time at that point, but you already have everything R&D'd, everything's programmed, everything's fixtured, everything's ready to go. And now you just double your output overnight. Whereas if you have two at the beginning, I'm inclined to think you would only be able to run one for quite a while. You don't have fixtures, you don't have processes, programs, you know, parts, things ready. So that's I think one, and then kind of a staggered situation is the way to go.
Yeah. I think it's like I'm probably going to pay more now for some options that I may not even really need. But again, like we talked about this too, which is I'm in a little bit of a different position than you because, okay, one, it's just me right now. Two, a lot of the work that I need to be doing is just custom folders. Mm-hmm. And the features around, I mean, honestly, if it was just custom folders and it was just my shop and we had a shop running that was doing like the Kihokus or whatever, there's like a good argument to be made that an X7 would be the best bet just for me for a prototyping machine almost.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Except for that, maybe I'm running two different machines or whatever, you know, it's just like a different, like brain space. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, man, I think this is good. The current plan is to keep my TM1. Okay. And to move that into the other shop. One, because I really can't fit two machines in my shop. Two, it starts to let me try the idea of this split shop method. Okay. And that machine basically becomes a dry machine.
Mm-hmm.
G10.
Yeah.
Kydex. It's not the best, like it runs into the same things. Like spindle speeds are slow, but it's still a second spindle.
Yeah. And the nice thing about scales I found is scales are one of those things that I feel totally fine walking away from while it's running.
Yeah.
Because it's like, there's just consequences are so low. Obviously, right. You don't want to crash the machine or anything like that, but it's not like if you're machining bevels or if you're machining like chamfers and perimeters and precision holes, like you have to be like really focused and the cycle times are usually not super long. And so you're kind of like on it. Whereas scales, if the machine is slow, it's like, okay, yeah, that sucks. Your throughput is limited, but you can walk away for 2 hours and just let the thing run and forget about it. You know what I mean? Because
once it's proofed,
if the whole pallet got ruined because of a work offset, it's like, okay, 10 pieces of G10 are gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what
your
I mean?
Tool's like, not, you're not going to probably break a tool in the middle of a cycle. If you did, you're only losing a couple more small tools.
Yeah.
Here's my other thought though, which is if I separate it, running scales and starting to like finish scales is actually like a pretty good employee task.
Yeah.
Cause it's the same things that you just said, which is it's low stakes. It's not, you're not crashing like a crazy fixture or an expensive tool.
Yeah.
And
materials are inexpensive and replaceable.
Materials are inexpensive. And it starts to be able to be like, cool, what do we need to finish scales? All right. You got to pull the scales out of the machine. You got to blast them, tumble, whatever it is. You got to clean out the dust. It's like a perfect kind of employee task.
Yeah.
To pair with other things.
Yeah, I was going to say pairing with other things because the way our shop basically runs is we have this work schedule of like what's going to be happening, what machines are going to be running. And basically the way it's been designed is that scales are always like the background noise of the shop. It's like
interesting.
It's always the peripheral thing is scales. So I don't ever have someone working in here who's like, you're just doing scales today.
Right, right. They're not a scale employee.
Well, no. And the reason being is like the cycle times are long on scales, especially on slow machines.
Yep.
Finishing them is way faster than they machine. Because if you're like sandblasting and oiling them, I mean, if you had an employee, quote unquote, running scales when you have an hour cycle time.
Right.
It's like,
what?
What are they actually doing? You know what I mean? Right. So So the way it always works is we have like, okay, today is finishing day on blades. It's like we're doing stonewashing, we're prepping for Cerakote, we're lasering logos. And by the way, keep the scales running in the background.
Right.
And that's, what I was talking about earlier is like, it's scales are one of the things where like the multitasking aspect doesn't bother me too much. It's like, let the thing run. It's going to run all day. We're going to basically ignore it except for when the thing needs changed over. Other than that, just let it run.
Just let it go.
Yeah.
Your scales are more efficient than mine. I'm still like prototype phase with a lot of parts where it's like, I'm still tabbing stuff. So it's like on mine, it's like you cut the tabs. I got to like do a little profiling.
Yeah.
So I'm slower and this is the goal, right? Is I need to free myself up enough to go back to development and improvements as opposed to just like, oh, I've got a show coming up. I need to make parts.
Yeah.
So I think this is, it'd be really interesting, man. It's exciting. I don't know timelines. I don't even know like exactly what I'm going to put in that other shop yet, but we do so many things that it's like, we're just stacked up. It's like, and there's a lot of little areas that can be increased. Like we're all set up to do like leather work. Right. And just like offer some of the Scout leather product line, and we don't have the space, you know? And so it's like starting to like split these things out. Ideally, my biggest fear about growth is that I lose like the part of knife making that I love, which is kind of like the free form artsy custom knife maker workflow. But at the same time, I know that I have like, from just a purely financial standpoint, I know that that's not like my working method. So I'm always striving for these things that create efficiency. But I think as a family, like we're at this point where I want to scale, but like the boys are old enough that I want to start bringing them in and teaching them shop work.
Yeah.
And I'm not ready to like convert my shop into the super efficient space. And so this is like this like dual personality shop vibe almost.
Yeah.
Like
one side
has to be efficient. Like I need to learn Kanban from you and like do that. But I also need to be able to grab a bar of steel, walk up to a bandsaw and make a prototype.
Yeah.
And not get in an employee's way and like not get, you know, not need to have table space that's not available. It's super weird. I realize it probably sounds weird, but it seems really fitting for me.
Yeah, it is fitting. No, I get it. And it's, I think having a new machine is going to make a world of difference because it's, I think aside from the machine being superior, I think it re-engages you with the optimization.
Yes.
Because if you have had a machine, how long have you had it? 10 years?
Yeah, dude, more than 14 years.
14 years. So it's like, I think there's sort of a rut that would happen with a piece of equipment that's old, where it's like, this is just the way that the things are set up. This is the fixturing. Like I just, everything I've done since then, I've sort of adapted to what I was already doing. Whereas a new machine is kind of like a fresh start. And it's like, if I'm going to build a fixture for a new machine, I'm going to do it the most modern, efficient way that I know how.
Yeah.
Whereas on an old machine that has all this existing tooling and fixturing, you sort of just like, you get stuck in between, like is what you're describing. You know what I mean? Is like, you kind of need a reset button of like, we're going this direction with the machining. You know what I mean?
That's actually a really good point, I think, in working process and like psychology in general, which would be like, I talk about ADHD tax. Like there's things that I do to allow me to be successful that I realize like I might be paying a premium for, right? Just little things. A friend of mine asked me around this machine, which I thought was one shows that like they kind of understand me, but like, it was about the shop. Basically, it's like, is the shop a burden or does it like give you a reason to like push again to like a next level? Does it create excitement, creativity, like all of these things? And I really think that like as makers, there is that there's this like recreation constantly, like where you get to a point, like you said, like I could run that machine and keep making parts the same way I'm doing it. Getting a new machine, knowing that I'm paying a lot of money for it, having all these new features is gonna give me like the interest and drive to kind of, I think, push some things to the next level.
It re-engages you with the process as opposed to it just being on autopilot. It's like, okay, we have to solve problems here because it's a new machine, meaning I need new holders, I need new fixtures. What are we putting in? And you revisit everything.
You also get to buy things.
Mm-hmm.
Get to like look at the new shiny thing. Get to look at new technology. Get to like, I'll have Haas come and give me training on this machine. I've never used a tool set or probe. Like, I think that when we're talking about long-term goals, I think this is really important. It's funny. So, you know, we've been doing the social media push and like just like adapting and doing different kind of plans. Now I've got some companies that are have sent me some like tools. Recently we reached out to a company in is it Korea that does these hot foil stamping machines, and basically just like gave them a pitch of like, hey, like here's some videos we've shot. I have a project coming up. I need a foil press. Would you be interested in like sending us one and we'll create a video? And they went for it. So it's pretty interesting. Like same thing about like time. I was super bored with social media. This is a way to like reinvigorate and like kind of incentivize it. But what's interesting is a lot of the videos we've shot, makers will come in and leave like a really negative comment around like the pencil maker was one of the most polarizing things that I've seen. People are either like, that's amazing, I want it, or people are like appalled that someone would pay $600 for a machine that makes pencils that you can buy for 5 cents.
Right.
But what I thought was interesting was a lot of those comments, I'd go to like look at the feed and it's a maker.
That's what's interesting.
Yeah. Right?
That's interesting.
I'm like, there was a blacksmith that I was like, I'm so intrigued that a blacksmith is leaving this comment about like the value of doing something slow. And he gave me a business response to it. Like, hey, in my business, I have to look at what is going to create value and profit for. And I'm like, you're a blacksmith.
Yeah. Right.
You're doing something because you love doing it.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. You're doing a craftsmanship based, like almost heritage based, but
antiquity, you know, man.
Artistic. Like, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what I see, I think a lot of times makers have a bias towards like not spending money as creating value for their business.
Yeah.
Your side less, like newer generation moving into like kind of a manufacturing field, I think way less. It's embracing technology. I think there's just a lot where it is still like purely bottom line driven. And it's almost like, not like a famine mindset, but like, do you know where I'm going with this?
So, you know, what's funny?
You're smirking.
can we go like really philosophical for just a minute?
Please.
So last night, I don't know why this came up so coincidentally, but last night I was like, for whatever reason, I had this thought. I was rolling around in my head while I was like laying in bed trying to fall asleep. And I was like, I should probably bring that up on the podcast. And interesting, we just kind of stumbled into it. Hold on, guys. Hold on. Just
wait. Okay.
Follow me here.
Okay.
I was thinking a lot about that in terms of like business mindset, as far as what are you trying to achieve, and thinking about like the profit mindedness.
Yeah.
And what's the goal of a company? How do you align yourself to be successful? All these things. And what I was thinking about is, profitability is a proxy for something else. So the amount of net profit that you make is not the measure of what you've achieved. It's a proxy for the actual thing that you've achieved. And that thing is that you've produced more than you've consumed. And the money and profit is a proxy for that. And right. So I think when I operate my business, it's like, I've always felt like there's a miss there, something of like, it doesn't feel like it's about profit, but the things I do feel like they are, like, I don't feel like, you know, I'm like conflicted. And then I realize the reason is, it's like, I want to add value to these materials and I want to produce more than I'm consuming.
Yes.
And that involves like consuming less and improving it. And then profit, that makes you sound like you're profit minded.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's like,
see that.
It's like a very base, like it's the very base principle of running a business, which is like, make more than you consume.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like this weird, I started going to this like thought process of like, man, that can go really far and wide, way outside of business. If you're starting to think about like how many things that we measure are actually proxies of a deeper thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where I think like, that came into my mind talking about like the pencil and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, talking about profit mindedness only,
right?
If you're focused on the proxy for the real thing, maybe it's like you're possibly misguided. I don't know. What do you think?
Okay, to carry this through, like, I think it works with like the concept of wealth in general, right? So you kind of have like these different things. It's like someone is rich or someone is wealthy. And like over the last couple of years, like I've done so much kind of like coaching work and stuff around figuring out like what my values are, what our goals are and all this. And I realize I'm like, the thought of being rich, it for me is like, it's not hollow. It's that if I frame it as wealth and as a balanced system, it's just not purely profit. And so why would my work also be purely profit? I'm like, if you're a maker and you're like this, I'm going to spend this money. I'm going to buy this toy and it's going to like give me some creative, like boost. Mm-hmm. Like there's value in that. It's right. It's like doing a seminar. It's just different. Right. Yep. Or if buying a new camera, you're not going to you're going to learn some new photography. Maybe your product photography photos get better, but not exponentially better to probably justify the purchase, but you're like, but now I have a sick camera and I enjoy this component of my job more.
Yeah.
I think that's wealth, right? Where you're like,
well, and part of it is like I said, make, or, you know, produce more than you make as the fundamental.
Produce more than you consume.
There's like, I feel almost like a moral tension about that being a good idea or good driver.
Yeah.
But also it's also an imperative, right? It's like, if you're not producing more than you're consuming, like,
but that's like the baseline. Is the baseline of business. I wanted to just baseline business, I probably wouldn't have been a knife maker.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say though is, that you can kind of open that a little bit further and say like, okay, well, what am I producing?
Sure.
Because if you're trying to like make sure that the value of what you're producing is more than what you're consuming, to your point, if you're producing, you're like basically you yourself, in my opinion, are a producer of creative energy.
Totally.
More than knives. You know what I mean? You're a producer of creative ideas, energy, direction.
Are you saying like, me specifically or you, us in
you,
general?
You.
Sure.
You,
yeah, I would agree with that, right?
You know what I mean? And so as like the designer that you are, as the brand builder that you are, as like the community builder that you are,
right?
Like those are the things that you're producing. And so someone who sees what they're producing as mainly the product sees that pencil and they're like, that's, you're consuming more than you're producing, like ping, like they're getting that little
interesting
response.
Yeah,
but it's like, but what's missed is that what you're producing is not like a physical product, which is like what you're implying.
Right.
is that you're producing value that is less directly tangible to someone who's like pure focused on I make the thing, I sell it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And
Yep.
so it's like,
Purely transactional.
yeah, but what you're doing is also
It
transactional.
is.
I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm just
No,
saying
no.
it's, but you're what people are buying from you in the grand scheme of things is that creative flow of energy, which for you to sustain requires a consumption of interesting things that may
Right.
seem unrelated.
It's
You know what I
fuel.
mean? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This was, I had an interesting conversation with Terrence yesterday, who's my coach. And I was like, he asked me, he's like, okay, you just went through the cycle. You're like doing a lot of work. You have like, there's some things that you get to be like proud of, like whatever. I was telling him, like, I'm already like on to the next thing. And he's like, you need to slow down, right? Like, good. But I was like, yeah, I owe myself. I was like, I need to get back on self-care, like get back in the gym. I always, he's like, can we just reframe this? He's like, you need to stop like telling yourself what you owe. He's like, you used a lot of fuel. How can you refill your tank? And I was like, oh man, that's like a very good reframe. It like removes this sense of self-judgment and is 100% accurate. And so if you look at it creatively, and this is where I don't, if someone is like, dude, it's stupid to pay $600 to build pencils. I don't want to do that. Like, I get it. That's not, I'm not disagreeing with it. What I'm saying is that I think there's, I think a lot of people don't spend time necessarily looking at like what they can do to like refuel themselves. And it is, it's like a, dang, I can't think of the word, man. What am I trying to say? Like a scarcity mindset, right? Where I think that looking at our work as something that is also refueling, if you look at that, if you're like, yes, my work has to provide for my family, but it also has to provide for me as a human. It can't, okay, yes, my work has to provide financial resources for my family, but it can't do that at the cost of being present for my family. Like, all this stuff is really like, once this is like a more established concept, right? I wish I had known some of this going in, but I also wasn't in a position where it really mattered. So like, these are learned traits over time, based on life changing and having different obligations and people that like count on you, including yourself, because when you first start, everything is exciting. But you're also, it's all learning, it's new machines, it's like having to work to get to some stage, right? And then you get to these stages, and it's really easy to just kind of plateau.
Well, and to expand on that too, it's like your creative gears that are turning require maintenance.
Yes.
As the machine that it is that has this conveyor belt of interesting things that come out, which you yourself, in my opinion, are like one of the best to do it in the knife industry of having this conveyor belt of just concepts, ideas, different angles and perspectives,
Right.
pure designs, as
Yeah.
well as like more 4D stuff, which is more
Yeah.
like ethereal, more like what if the brand had this feel to it? You know what I mean? Like
Yeah,
that,
totally. Yep.
the way that the machine in your brain works to produce that stuff requires that machine requires maintenance. And that's where it's like I said, there's the consumption side and
Yeah.
there's the production side. And
That's
it's
pretty
like
interesting.
you have like a line item that's like a maintenance expense, which is like I have to do something interesting or I disengage. You know what I mean? And it's like a machine needs oil in its whey oil, or it fails. You know what I mean?
Dude,
And
that
so,
is, I don't think I've ever, you just explained it really beautifully. So let me ask you this then. If you see that as my friend externally, right? What is it? And I have a sense of this maybe, but like, what is your equal to that? Because it's not going to be the same as mine, right?
No, for me it's I think a little bit about that because it's like I think where you and I are different is like I like, I'm an optimizer.
Right. It's the optimization.
Like being the idea guy isn't actually what I like the most.
Yeah.
I like can force myself to come up with ideas to like progress things forward to whatever, design
Right.
things,
By
whatever.
default, you have to.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, I guess I have enough capability there to do it, but where I really feel like my calling is, like where my machine is most valuable, is in the optimizing. And that's where like the process is the product thing is so prevalent for me, is like the machine, like my brain is optimizing everything around me all the time to
All
the
the
point of
time.
like annoyance, you know what I
Yeah.
mean? And I think where I need a break from that is that I need to optimize something that doesn't matter, because I can't not optimize, but I have to go find something else to optimize that is meaningless because there's no pressure
But
anymore.
it's
And
your, but that's your process. So, right, when I'm looking for something external, I'm learning something that doesn't matter.
yeah, it's important that it doesn't matter,
Right, has to not
because that's
matter.
what makes it refilling.
Yeah.
Because your brain, you're going to create the ethereal ideas and be the creative, idea guy that you are all day, every day for the rest of your life.
Right.
But if all of that time is spent on stuff that is extremely consequential, it takes more than you can sustain.
Then
And
you can sustain,
that's what I
right?
notice, like when I work on this, like this Jeep that I have, I think about it all day long, like on the weekends, of like, okay, I want to take all the carpet out. I want to shampoo the carpet. While I'm there, I want to DynaMat the floorboards, spray paint any rust. And it's like, that's how I think, is like, I want to optimize this Jeep. But guess what? If I don't take the carpet out and shampoo it, what's the consequence?
Right.
Nothing. Right. And that's what makes it a refilling experience for me, is that I'm actually doing the same thing that I do at work, but I'm doing it in a world where who cares? It's only up
Who
to me.
cares?
I'm the only one that sees the result, and I'm the only one that it matters to. So I can do it at my own pace, and it can just be fun. You know what I mean?
That is very interesting, dude. So, okay. As okay, so here's like another, like, I guess not philosophical. I'm gonna side note, my brain is like firing. So something I realized recently, I've never been good at long-term plans. Okay. If you ask me, like, hey, what's your 5-year goal? Dude, I've never had one. What I realize is because of how my brain works, a lot of times if I set a 5-year goal, I actually just, it's important enough to me. Like, to be honest, dude, having a shop space and buying an investment property was a 5 to 10 year goal that I laid out last year. That's a prime
Here we
example.
are.
Here we are, right? It's like, I have time blindness. I don't have that ability to be like, here's the steps that I'm going to take over the next 4 years to end up here. Okay. So if, The for me, it was this idea of removing timelines from goals has been super, super helpful. Right now, I have a goal, but I actually don't have a concept of how to achieve it. For my brain, that's the best way to do it because it's not trying to hold it to some weird line. Back to the original thought, which was for you said, in a position in your company, like you don't want to necessarily be the idea generator. And I'm the opposite, right? Like I look and I'm like, I would essentially like to be like the creative director, like prototype weirdo of my own company. So if you scale past the point of your ability, right? Who gets put where? Because I would basically be putting someone who is more efficient than me in charge of efficiency. If you scale past your ability to generate the ideas, where does that go?
Yeah, no, and I've thought about that a lot, is that it's I'm in conflict with this quite a bit, actually, to be honest, is that I don't know that I don't know that I love designing stuff, which sounds insane.
Hold on. Let's just like you do that. That is a mind-blowing statement. And it also makes like perfect sense in this, again, just of knowing you, I can see that. But can you like dig into it?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, it's like my dad's a designer at heart, right? And maybe I got a little bit of the talent that he has to where it's like, if I sit down and kind of make myself do it, I do feel like I have to kind of make myself do it, but like I can get it my in the right headspace to design. But in a weird way, it's almost like I want it to immediately become optimization. So it's almost like I want to rush through the process of like sitting there and just being extremely ethereal or like random. And I want to accelerate as soon as like my brain just, I need something to optimize. And when I'm just thinking about too broad of a scope, it just frustrates me because it's like, as soon as I've got a row of 3D prints in front of me, of like sequencing through a new design, right? Once I get here, I like it a lot because I'm optimizing. But when I'm staring at a blank screen and I'm like, I have to come up with the idea for what foundationally this is going to be, I just don't like that. I'm like, I want something to optimize. You know what I mean?
Dude, that is super interesting. That, okay, what, like, so what in optimizing, so in work, so this is back to the original question, right? Which is like, if I have this mechanism for keeping myself engaged in the shop, which is like to essentially do inefficient things sometimes and buy a new tool and play with it and like use it incorrectly and learn something from that. And that's what keeps me charged. What in the business, like what in manufacturing is your like guilty pleasure that keeps you filled up? Is that?
Yeah, for me, and the more we talk about this, like this is enlightening because I have thought about this, but I've never brought it up to this degree. But going into like a space or a design that's already somewhat materialized and like and just grinding on the details of like looking at like a machine and thinking like this bench is 1 foot too long. It would be better if the bench was a little bit shorter and if the machine was like a foot back and then we had this rack right and then like visualizing like
Totally
what
get
is the ideal
it.
optimized zone for this like corner of the shop for efficiency, like for just being tight and clean. And I don't, and it's like that's just, I'm realizing that's what my brain does. It takes material that's already there and improves it. And when I have to, like generate the material initially, that's doable, but like the frustrating part. It's almost like a writer's block is kind of how it feels like when I'm looking at a blank screen. I just immediately am like, well, now I don't want to do it because there's nothing to
There's a
optimize yet.
barrier to entry that's
Yeah.
like, but now, right now, my brain's not in the space to create the idea.
Yeah. Because it's like what I found is when I'm designing, it's like as soon as, and I'm talking like this because I'm designing a knife right now and it's been a while since I have. And it's like once it grabs me where I'm like, that's what it's going to be, but it's not there yet. That's when it gets really fun for me is like you know how like the last 10% of a design takes 90% of that is my favorite part. And it's like the first part of just like the rough sketches and stuff. It's like, I don't enjoy it,
So
which is
that
opposite to
is,
you from what I perceive.
yeah, I can generate tons and tons of rough sketches, and then it slowly breaks down as it, like, by the time I'm getting to CAD, like, a lot of the initial spark has like burned off.
And that's, I start to get the spark
You start to
at that
get the
point.
spark at that point. And it's starting to change a little bit. And this is like flow state requires like a level of proficiency to be able to do the thing. So I know that I like flow state, right? When I sketch knife designs, I can just, my brain clicks in and it's like, I'm not a good artist. I just can sketch 2D designs that my brain can imagine as 3D. Okay. Now that I'm getting to a point with Fusion that I can actually make it do what I want, I'm getting way more hooked in. The problem for me is I'm cyclical. So I know that I get a couple weeks to a couple months of really being able to focus on one thing. You don't have that as much, right? Like you're pretty linear in the way, like for efficiency, especially, like you're making consistent improvements up the line. Where I'm like making something kind of consistent over here, and then I leave it and I forget and I jump over here. Is it like that when you were talking about shop organization and stuff, like every few months I look at the shop and I'm like, man, that machine needs to go over there. And it's all I want to do. I want to build shelves. I want to like organize things. And I like usually will allow myself to do that. It's really interesting to look at these jobs as like the point, like a lot of, I guess, founders of like tech companies, maybe is like, it's not direct, but it's like, if you're someone who loves coding, right? And then you scale a company and you're not the coder anymore. Where do you find the interest? It's like, so for you, if you scale past you being like the alpha omega almost of like everything, like generating process, generating design, generating sales, photos, mark, everything. It's like, where do you slip into? And I guess I don't know, like in our industry, I don't really know that there's a lot of case studies. Like, okay, Chris Reeve, Rick Kinderer, who else? Emerson, right? And I know there's more.
Those are the more public notable
Those
ones,
are
because
kind of like big
like there's
ones.
a I think about it, there's a lot of stories that just weren't shared because like the way that they ran the company, they weren't
Right.
public
They
facing.
weren't public
So
facing.
there's so many companies that you look around, like you look at Essie or Bussy or all
Totally.
these
You don't
fixed-plate
know
companies. It's
the.
like who exact like we know the owner's names, but like
Right.
we don't really know the story all that much. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, that's pro tech, same
Like
kind
the
of
Chris
thing. Like
Reeve
I know a
story
little bit of that. Right.
is like fabled. It's like
Right. And
if you've been
it's
around, you know the
recognizable.
yeah. But I think there was more publicity around the story, and that's part of it. 'Cause he could have just been the ghost that never talked about any of that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. But his is, again, it's like you look and you're like, okay, that's a knife maker to factory. But I wonder about that a lot, where I'm like, what is the day to day? How do you stay engaged? Because I look at that and I'm like, man, there's an element of kind of scaling. And I've experienced this a little bit where you can like work yourself out of the job that you like doing.
I think why this has worked for me, because I've said before, like manufacturing is where I
Yeah.
really found myself.
Yeah.
And it's partly because I'm optimizing,
Yeah.
everything needs optimized. And it
Yeah.
doesn't, optimizing spreadsheets for accounting
Yeah.
feels good to me. I like it
See?
because it doesn't have to be like optimizing a design of a knife. It doesn't have to be optimizing a
Right.
shop
It's
space,
anything.
but like production, like
Yeah.
at a high level, like production flow, like looking at a shop, where are parts moving, looking at the economics of the whole thing, like that, optimizing all that and like fine tuning it is, it just feels good. I like it.
It sounds so corny to say like find your why, right? But like around work, I just had this flash memory of I was probably 18 or 19 and I went on a camping trip with a friend's family and I was going nuts because I wasn't working. And my friend's mom knit. And she gave me a set of knitting needles and a ball of yarn and like taught me how to knit. And I was like, it doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter what you're optimizing. It's like, for me, it's like the same. It's like, it doesn't matter what I'm learning or making. It just matters that I am in that. So like messing around with, woodworking tools that make pencils or chopsticks or whatever, that actually makes more sense now. 'Cause it's almost like project agnostic. Like you could put me on any, like, oh, what are we making? We're gonna make a chair? Okay.
Yeah,
Like,
that, like I said,
cool.
that little whatever in your brain that is like needing that thing to do, it just it just needs to do that cycle. Do that it's like stuck in a loop for the rest of our lives. Like, and that's just, we're just born that way. And so it's like, it's just, I think feeding, like I said, feeding things into it that also don't matter. Because yeah. when you find that it can do valuable things, like I can, my optimization abilities can do valuable things. There's the temptation is that it's too valuable to ever feed anything into it that isn't producing something net positive.
Right.
And so you get into this trap where you burn yourself out because it's like yeah. everything is consequential that's going into this process, into this mind loop. And it's like, it, if you put something unproductive in it, it sounds like it's just a waste of time, right? Like, why would I, I'm building a company. I've got two small kids. Like, why yeah. would I take the carpet out of my XJ? I had a brand new Jeep under warranty. I sold it and bought a 97 right. Jeep. Why would I bring that burden onto my plate when I have all this other stuff on my plate? But what I realized is like, there is nothing to optimize in a brand new vehicle. Really.
There's no problem
and
to
it
solve.
Was boring
There's
to me.
No, yeah, it's boring.
And I realized the reason I liked the Jeeps that I had before this new one were that they were broken. And there was like a small oil, you know what I mean? It was like,
totally. Yep.
It's like they need fixed. They're not optimized. Whereas a brand new car, it's like, it's already optimized. Like what, it's boring to me. You know what I mean? So it's like that's just what, the reason I keep circling back to that is like, that feels like what was missing for me for a few years now.
Yeah.
Is all I had to optimize was stuff that freaking was stressful. You know what I mean? Like there's
yeah, right. And that yeah. is all, it's same for me. It's like I've yeah. gone through these cycles where all of my shop time, all of my creative time came at the stakes of yeah. business.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's, I want to like try to get some actual like concepts out of this, which would be one. Okay. Not a concept. How many maker, like in your experience of our industry, what percentage of makers do you think are in alignment with like their ability and you know, just what exactly what we talked about?
Yeah.
Or do you think a lot of makers are focused on one area or the other? I can see yeah. both, right?
Yeah. Well, one thing, the kind of shark under the water here is that like, if you're a one man shop,
yes,
and you are going to make knives, you have to do it all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that is sort of the ultimate sort of, I don't know, like,
but you still have a bias.
Yeah. It's unavoidable.
Right. Yeah. It's unavoidable. Yeah. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I was just gonna say, it's like the unavoidable truth that until you have delegation, you can't go like full into what you're very best at.
Like your strength. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, I think that's why when I started to hire people, it started to change for me of like, oh, I can spend more of my time optimizing. And it's like, I didn't know that at the time. I thought I was a designer. I thought that was like, that's who I was. Right. And it
it's
took
who
like,
you were,
but I don't think
these things shift, yeah,
but
right?
I don't think I ever was, because like,
interesting.
I always had trouble motivating myself to design. And I think what I realize is after I would hand a design to a company, let's say,
yeah,
guess who doesn't get in to optimize it, right?
Yeah.
It's like I did the idea part, which is the part that I don't love, but I can do.
Right. And then the lose part out that on I, the optimizing.
The part
it.
That I'm the that I love the most is being delegated away if I design, right? And so that's why manufacturing clicked for me, is like, no, I didn't realize that on the other side of that fence is where I belonged. You know what I mean? Like, so
dude, this, and these are things like, I don't think you don't realize them till you realize them.
Mm-hmm.
Sound, and I know that's so basic to say that, but like, it's like laying out a shop. You could put every tool in the shop without ever working in it and then be like, wait, that doesn't go there. There's yeah. only so far you can take something.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
at this point in your career, at this age, this stage of life, you are like having these realizations, but you're also in a position to be able to adapt to it. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that is the key.
And so let me ask you, let me say this to
Yeah.
you. You're on the other side of the fence. You
Yeah.
produce the valuable ideas at a
Yeah.
way higher rate than I can or do. And if you, I would be, I guess if you try to become an optimizer,
Yeah.
would you be unhappy? You know what
Yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, and I know
So,
that. What I need things that are seasonal, and I think I have tendencies that for a period of time, like they're there and then they go away. And I need to be really careful about what systems I put in place that are going to make me do that thing that's not going to be there all the time. And I think that probably where we're getting to now is a better, is like a better place. But I mean, you do look at it and you're like, what does an investment property have to do with knife making your business? And like, it's a risk and it's an expense. But it, I look, I'm like, yeah, but it's diversification. And for me, I guess maybe it's not optimizing, but it is, it's like analysis of options and resources. So an area where I would look is like all of my money at this point comes from the knife industry. Even though I could make the argument that I am pretty diverse in the knife industry, I'm still all in that industry. And that felt like a weak spot to me. So this idea of a property, now it's real estate. But I've used my resources from knife making to leverage myself into real estate, which is truly outside of the knife industry. So it tracks for me as far as that like process. So, but it does, you know, it's like, dude, it is really interesting. Like the same question for you, even though you love optimizing. Do you have the same thing where it's like if you got into a position in your own company where your only job was to optimize, right? Or optimize in one area as opposed to right now, you're optimizing across all of these different fields inside of your business. If you don't have to do that, it's like, do you enjoy that?
Time will tell. I don't
But do you take steps towards that or do you
know.
take
Honestly, the good news is, if I'm going to call myself that, an optimizer, I suppose, I've never been more buried in things to optimize.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so there's the silver lining is like the alignment is there, but I have X amount of compute as well. And so it's like the funnel is bigger than the hose, you know what I mean? So
Right. Do
it's
you do it
like,
at home? Here's a weird question. Like, do you do it at home? Like, do you try to optimize things that Becca's doing? And why does she hit you?
yeah, no, that's a
Do,
thing.
right?
That's a thing.
Yeah.
That's 100% a
Is it
thing.
a
Yeah.
pain point? Like, does it
Yes.
create?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it when it comes to like the where it flares up the most is like if we do like home projects.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
She's amazing. She likes to build things.
Yeah.
She does a great job,
She can do it.
but she
Yeah.
likes to do it free form. She likes to
Yeah.
just do it.
Yeah.
I can't do it. So like we actually have resolved to like if she's doing a project, she does it. If I'm doing a project, I do it.
That's
You know what I
marriage.
mean? And
Yeah.
it works. It's fine. But like we learned that the hard way. Like we renovated our whole house and it's
Yeah.
like I'm trying to optimize everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I'm trying to think of an order of operations. Like you wouldn't want to paint this because it's doesn't have trim on that window and it's the same color as that wall and that wall's does have trim. And so I'm like, you know what I mean? So I'm just trying to think of all, and she's just like, I just want to paint the wall. I want to see how it
Yeah, I'm gonna
looks.
do it. That's Matt. Maddie does the same way. I struggle with it, and I'm trying to like work. It's a me issue. Like I'm trying to work through it, but it's easy to do. It's like consulting in your relationship. It's like you don't want to consult your partner, you know?
So yeah, I mean, we found a good balance, but like that's something we had to learn, and it is clearly in line with the way that I
Yeah.
operate.
Do you have any hobbies or or is there a value if you optimize? It's almost like the idea of like you like to optimize things that aren't work, don't have structure. Is there value for you in having something that is actually the opposite of that, where it's like you have to struggle through being unoptimized or doing something more freeform? Do you have anything like that?
I think a full unplug, going to like the mountains and
you
like,
do that,
no,
but you optimize it.
Because my favorite thing in the world is backpacking.
Right.
Do you know why that is?
Because you can optimize it.
Because it requires planning.
To. Yeah.
And if you don't,
yeah,
it sucks.
It's a it, that is a that yeah. is a life or death,
yeah,
like test of your planning and optimization in a way.
Yep. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We like an example is my wife and I, when we were dating, we did a huge loop in Idaho in the backcountry in the Jeep. And I had this paper map and like mapped out all fuel stations, all gaps between fuel is like 159 miles from this gas to this gas, 620 miles total. That's going to require three fill-ups. What's the best spacing? And it was like, and then we went and did the drive, which was awesome. But like my whole brain the whole time was so stoked, 'cause I'm like, everything is exactly right. You know what I mean? Like the gas is where I thought it was going to be. We did have enough fuel like that. That's the way I just handle things.
You're the planner, man.
And I've been called an overthinker. Like when I was, I don't hear it a lot anymore, but like when I was young, that was like the most common thing. Be like, dude, you're overthinking it. That was like, that was always.
Same.
Yeah.
You know what?
Yeah.
It's fine. Like
yeah.
There's strength and weakness and all that. And there's a lot of traits that when you're a kid, like we're dealing with some of it with Bo right now where I see it and I'm like, that's going to serve you really well. But not right now, because right now you need to stop arguing with me about this like point that is valid, but not relevant to like you putting on your pajamas.
Yeah,
exactly. Right? Like it's great. But and it's like, okay, I don't want to tell him he's overthinking. I don't want to tell him like, because I grew up with a few, like hearing a few things that I still hear, right? Which was, I argue everything and I'm contrary. But as a negative, okay? And that, I think for a long time, I heard that like my dad would tell me that I was talking too loud. And for a while, as I got older, I got really quiet. And I look and I'm like, because I was self-conscious about being too loud. But I look, I'm like, yeah, but I'm like, you're an excited kid. Or if you're arguing and being like contrary, it's because your brain is running through all these things. And it's like, you're just problem solving. So I try not to like not do that.
Well, I'm going to say that right now, because I'm can be kind of a contrarian too. And I think I actually really like talking to contrarians.
Yeah.
Because as one myself,
yeah,
when I talk to someone and I like my, that underlying level of like, I want to disagree with them.
Yeah.
Not because I disagree,
Matt?
But like, I want to see like what they're like with the X, this Haas and X9. It's like I want to like be in a front, because I want them to flesh out what they're saying.
Yeah.
And I want them to push back.
Yeah.
And it's like, if I'm talking to someone, they don't push back and they like, it's like they don't want to be contrary to me at all. It actually is like hard to talk, because it's like, no, I want to like push on each other in this conversation.
You
want to
dig in.
I want someone to push back on me. And it's like, I know that could be sound toxic, but like,
no, it's not. Well,
the best friends that I had through my life, I think, were ones that we would talk like politics or about work or about career. And it was like, some would say it almost looks like an argument, but it's like those, it's like that they become my best friends because they push on me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. There's people that like, not everything has to be a debate. And then you're like, but that's assuming that like debate is a negative.
It's not negative. That's
it's
how
not a
I
negative.
feel. And
It's
I can,
how you
I know
learn.
That's how you feel. Yeah.
Dude.
So it's like, I think it's important though to be careful, because it's like, yeah, there are, I have to reel that in when it's like, there isn't a reason to disagree right now. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's not that it requires no management. It's just that it's important to note that like, I've found I get along better with other contrarians most of the time.
In people who are thinking. like thinking
Yeah.
through random or able to put themselves out of their own immediate bubble to discuss something that is like secondary,
Yeah.
but
Yeah.
from a philosophical standpoint, you know, this that's a good one. That's a good one for advice too. Like I keep trying to think about like this from like maker standpoint a little bit, where there's so much advice about a tool, a process that when you're first starting out, it's really hard to parse. Like, is this good advice for me, or is this good advice for someone in a different position? It's funny. I had a buddy buying a rifle yesterday, and he's like, "How do you think about 300 Win Mag?" He's like, "The guy at the counter was really just like, ah, there's like, you know, there's 6.5 Creedmoor, and there's like more modern shells, and like all this stuff." And I'm like, "But why? Like, there's a point where you're like, what is his why? What does he need out of that he's saying that? And does he know what you want out of it? Does he know that you want a rifle that you can like go hunt with, but maybe also shoot like a precision rifle match or like, I don't know, whatever." Like, it's just you have, I don't know the way of like phrasing the informational component of that, where it's like the source of your information. And it almost gets harder as your network gets more specific and more talented, right? So if I go to Keaton and ask him about a machine, he's going to give me his very high level watchmaker advice on a machine. There's a very real possibility that I don't need that, right? Or there could like there's just so many areas. So it's like you almost, I think at this point, when I look for advice, I look for people who are doing close to what I'm doing, but maybe at a higher level, right? It's like same thing. Like you go to Emmanuel Esposito or something and ask about making folders, and he's gonna have a different answer than I am, right? You have to figure out where you're at in that like spectrum.
Yeah, and that's where I did an interview with Zach in the Wild the other day, and he did a YouTube video, kind of a like video podcast, I guess you would say. And that's one of the things him and I discussed. And I really like talking to him because
Same.
he's got this philosophical approach. He's classically trained. I mean, he went to college for philosophy and all that.
Right.
So, but we were talking about all that stuff, like advice.
Yeah.
And I kind of had landed on that conversation, then kind of discussed like advice is you got to be skeptical of advice. I
Yeah.
think like that's a classic beginner mistake is to take all advice in
Yeah.
and just have it in concrete, like all of
Right.
it,
Right.
because a lot of it is conflicting and a lot of it is not right. And but some of it is on the right track, some of it's perfect advice.
Right.
You like, and that's where that like contrarian kind of thing of like, you kind of have to disagree with someone and like kind of fish around to figure out why they are where they are. And
Right.
I think that's where that comes from for me is like when I disagree with someone about something small, it's like me requesting that they explain themselves so that I can understand.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like,
That's
so
what a lot of people don't like about it.
yeah.
Because there's a certain personality type that's like, if you are questioning this or asking this question, you are questioning me
Yeah.
versus
The
being
idea.
curious about the concept.
Yeah.
But people don't, a lot of people don't like to be put on the spot.
Yeah. And that's where like I think I've gotten okay at reeling that in, but I think the where it is like I'm like a heat-seeking missile when I find someone no joke, when I find someone that like flat out disagrees with me, it's like a freaking magnetism. It's like
Yeah.
no, I want to understand why,
I
you know what
want
I
to
mean?
know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
It's
pretty
a
funny.
very strong trend when I think back right now, like, and I haven't thought about this very much before, but yeah. And that's like, I think that's
Dude.
why you and I get along, honestly.
Yeah, it really is. Today's conversation is like a perfect example of like this, where I don't know if it makes good podcasting, but it's what makes a good conversation for me. Like, right?
I disagree.
Yeah.
No, I'm just
I would like you to optimize some of these like concepts where it's like, how can you look at your business from a like, what is the worksheet for a philosophical business where you look and you go, hey, what is the driver for me to do this? Like, where was my entry point? What does it look like if it scales? What are the risks of scaling or like not scaling? Or what is the method? What is it that I'm trying to scale? Right? Do you love machines so much that you just want like a factory full of machines? And that's what's going to be the thing where you're like, bought a new machine. And because we know people like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to never make something? Do you never want to do CAD ever? Like, because there is a way to optimize that. You just have to decide on it, right?
Yep. And I think that maybe like a title for this episode almost is kind of know yourself. You know what I mean? It's like, it takes a certain amount of pressure and time and experiences and failures to get a little bit better handle on that.
Definitely.
And, you know, I'm at the very surface of that, trying to understand that. But like, yeah, that's where that advice thing comes in, is like, you got to know yourself. Are you the same as that person that's giving you the advice? You might not be, you know what I mean?
And yeah. Like, do they have the same, do they have the same drivers? Do they have the same? Well, it's really funny. Like, this is like a blanket statement, but like, you have an Android phone. I have an Apple. Okay. Sile makes perfect sense for you in this method of like open source. Yep. Haas is kind of like an Apple
very similar
product.
Yeah. I've always said that.
And that is like a really base level justification for like a way of like looking at a scenario and being like, where's the advice? Yeah. Like, what is the overarching goal or need? Or
your filter is different than mine. So it's
different.
You get similar results for everything you pass through years.
I wonder if there's almost a way that you could build, like, can you build a chat to like do that? Can you build like a, you know, like a, just a GPT to like run, like, here's my criteria. I need to be creative. I need to do this. Or you like run questions through it.
Sounds like something we could do.
It's like, it's pretty fun, man. Yeah. Or can I build a chat to like help me be more efficient in that way? Like, to optimize, like, here's the things that I'm doing. I don't know. I haven't gotten that like deep in it. I'm using it more and more though for different tasks.
I haven't gotten into it very much, but I find it very interesting.
I recently had someone tell me, I forget what the other, I've only messed with ChatGPT. I had someone else tell me that like, they're like, ChatGPT works for these tasks, but this one is more morally aligned with me. And I was like,
that's a crazy thing to say.
Interesting concept. I know. And I just like, I can't, my recall is not good enough to remember what the other, it's like one of the
Grok or Llama or.
No, it's one of the other main like AIs right now. I'll find it and I'll send it to you. And it was a, like a trusted human who's super intelligent and just being like, when I'm asking these type of questions,
I get along with this one better.
I get along with this one better. And I was like, what?
That's so crazy, man.
Dude, should we wrap it?
Yeah, it's Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Probably ought to go hang out with the beautiful wife.
Good plan. We are very fortunate to have supportive and wonderful wives.
Of course.
Who tolerate our weird predispositions.
Yeah. She married a contrarian who optimizes. So sorry.
Oh man. Dude, that was a super fun one. You guys, thank you for listening. And we're just gonna keep rolling these when we have time and things to talk about, and shoot us a message. Yeah. Stay in touch.
Appreciate you guys.
Appreciate you guys.
Peace.